Hello and welcome to Horrorspiria. My name is May.
And I'm Clinton.
And this is the first episode of our new year. We're going to be looking at American films done with foreign visions, and we'll talk about what that means in a little bit.
Okay, cool. American films done with foreign visions, huh?
Yeah.
So what would be an example of that for the listeners?
Sure. So today we're going to be looking at Midsommar, Green Inferno, and Eyes of My Mother. There is a really popular example with Hostel. Midsommar was also extremely popular, but in general, these are American films made by American directors that have decided for one reason or another to set their films in lands that are not America, or to have main characters that are not American. And we always talk about horror being a projection of cultural anxieties. And it is interesting then to think of the transnationalist context as to what that means per se, especially when American films are dominant in every single market, including the Western world. So I thought that this would be an interesting project for us to look at for the beginning of the year.
Great. Cool. So we've both seen some of the, like you were talking about, Midsommar was just in theaters recently. So probably a lot of listeners saw that too. Eyes of My Mother, that's on Netflix right now in the US. Is that right?
That's right.
And that came out a couple years ago?
It came out a couple of years ago. And the director, Nicholas Pesch, he has a film out this weekend. He did The New Grudge. So that'll be interesting.
The New Grudge. Wow.
Yes. So he kind of, like Eli Roth, he kind of seems to have an obsession with foreign objects kind of influencing his own work, or foreign influence influencing his own work. So we'll see how that looks like. I think his film was the strongest of the three. So it's interesting to see why people want to do this. And we looked at the reasoning behind a lot of these films, and I'm really intrigued to pick that apart.
Yeah, just as a casual viewer, is the trick just make the setting in a foreign place to make it scarier, like make it somewhere unfamiliar to the audience?
Well, that's the conversation that opens up, right? Like, what is the intersection of these different influences? For example, Midsommar is pretty much a rave review film. I mean, a lot of casual viewers didn't really like it, but especially in horror critiques, it is viewed as one of the most original visions of the last 20 years or so.
Really?
And it's just interesting to kind of explicate why people feel that way. And when we get to Midsommar, I'll also talk about the Swedish response to it. And I think that's just kind of the thing. I think a lot of these filmmakers, especially people like Eli Roth, rely on the American horror viewer to be stupider than the typical horror critic, or even just the typical American viewer, and to kind of just make big assumptions about foreign groups of people, which is something Americans are really good at doing.
Yeah.
So I think it depends on the vision. And I think all three of these filmmakers specifically tackled this intersection with varying results and with varying respects. So I think it's a good start to look at for the beginning of this year, and seeing how our obsession sometimes with exoticism, that I think is largely cultural and not just, you know, specific to certain people, especially when we're considered the land of the free, the land of the cultural mixing pot. You know, it even brings up the question, you know, what does it mean to be an American? Even though I will say that all three of these films are directed by white American men, I think the one that is the most quote-unquote immigrant is Nicholas Pesch. He said that his grandparents came from Italy. So, you know, it's all about just...
What about Eli Roth? He always... Do you know anything about his background?
I think he was just... I know he's not an immigrant, a children of immigrants or anything. He was raised all his life in America, very much an American red-blooded man, and kind of very proud of that. He did marry a Chilean.
Yes, who he met on the set of this movie, right? That we're going
to
talk about. On
Green Inferno, yeah. But just to kind of even prove just how pig-headed Eli Roth is, when he first met her, he assumed that she didn't speak English. And then she spoke flawless English. And he was like, oh, great, I'm going to cast you in this film. So, you know, I think Eli Roth represents one end of the spectrum. And then we have people kind of like Nicolas Pesch, and in ways, Ari Aster, you know, compromising the other end of the spectrum and how to deal with this with sensitivity somewhat. But it's just varying. And so this is the first kind of batch that we're going to look at. I'm always really intrigued whenever there's like transnationalism, whether it's coming from the American perspective or whether it's a Korean film about Japanese nationals, or whether it's a Korean film with Americans in it, like Bong Joon-ho likes to do a lot. So it's a little slice into what the American voice looks like, especially these three films were quite popular for different and varying reasons as well.
All right, well, yum yum, let's get into this slice.
All right, okay, so we'll get started with Green Inferno.
That perfect. Came out, yum, yum.
Mm-hmm, that came out in 2013.
Peru is dangerous. We can't just go invade a country because they're doing something that we think is immoral.
I know. I just think I should be doing something about the rainforest. Starlight,
two drops. It's time to make a difference. Sounds of the
moon.
Why are they doing this? What are they going to do to us? We have to get out of here.
You know what this is? You know what they're doing to us?
All right, and that was a bit of Green Inferno, which was directed and written by Eli Roth in 2013. He says that this is his homage to 70s, 80s cannibal films, specifically Cannibal Holocaust. And yeah, and so you saw Green Inferno, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Did you see it?
I have skimmed throughout most of it, but okay. In general, I have a very strong objection to Eli Roth, and we'll get into that. But yeah, so what did you think?
So I think this movie, and a lot of what we're talking about, is kind of, we'll touch on this, but this movie was probably the most objectionable as far as problematic imagery, the whole idea of a cannibalist tribe, and then you just show brown people eating meat, and it's like, oh my God, but it's supposed to be humans. And oh my God, the close-ups of tearing away at a drumstick or whatever. Like, that whole othering primal animal that these people are civilized people, to rely so much on that for your horror was clearly not okay.
Yeah, and that is actually what this film was most known for. There was this indigenous kind of nonprofit called Survival International that protested this film, saying that it was very harmful towards indigenous groups. You know, this film was made in 2011, I think, and then released in 2012, 2013. So it was getting to the point where I feel like our mainstream culture was becoming more aware of problematic depictions of this, because Eli Roth does kind of have a point. In the 70s and 80s, this was an extremely popular trope where it would be this group of savages on some kind of brown island, and they would be cannibals, and all of the white people would kill them. That's essentially what Cannibal Holocaust is about. And so you could definitely see where Eli wanted to do this film as an homage, but it's kind of like, why do you want to do an homage to that specifically? And even Eli Roth, when he was criticized for that by Survival International, he dismissed them by saying that this was a fictional story, that clearly indigenous groups are just mad at corporations and they shouldn't be mad at filmmakers like him. And he disavowed all public responsibility as to what his story was implying, which I think is just the most egregious part of it, period.
Yeah. Yeah. There were a lot of parts of this movie. Now, I will say this movie is like an hour and a half. Not excusing its depictions and its whole premise. Eli Roth does know how to make, he knows how to make a funny movie. He knows how his, I think his pacing is good. He hits some notes that I'm like, okay, I get why people love him and love his movies. I think the ending of the movie, it has like one of the, like a pretty satisfying end. It is stupid, but it's also smart at points. So I actually enjoyed this movie more than I thought I would. Even given, you know, how it deserved to tank, it doesn't, I'm glad it wasn't some huge phenomenon, because that would have been more harmful and more damaging. Yeah, but like he tries to poke fun at some other groups too, and he has some activists as some of the leading characters. And as somebody who does some activism work in DC, it was kind of fun to see, like, oh, wow, he really casted some people who look like they could run in activism circles. And some of the other casting was a little hit or miss. But yeah, an uneven, super problematic ride for sure.
Well, isn't Alejandro the one that tricks the kids into coming on the premise of activism?
Yeah, I mean, they're all and like so in their group.
Yeah, but that even still underlies the motion that, oh, okay, this person of color, Alejandro, is the one that lured you in here to do these good things. So it's not even, I actually don't think it's smart at all. I think he's just a really lucky idiot.
Well, I mean, there are moments, it's not just a stupid person can't make a funny movie. Or there are parts of this where I think we disagree on that, but yeah, I do. Well, I don't think he's stupid. And I think that might be more damning, you know, that if he is smart enough to pull off this movie with some twists and some unexpected beats, that he should have been smarter to maybe avoid it altogether or come up with a way where it could work, but maybe a white guy just shouldn't even try because it just might not even be approachable.
The problem that I have with that defense, because that's been the defense for Eli Roth since Hostel, which Hostel actually is a film that fits perfectly into the theme of this podcast today, where it's this American vision of what these quote-unquote savages overseas will do. But in this sense, I think Hostel, where is Hostel set?
It's... They say, but it just feels like some Eastern European. Yeah. It's not Germany, but maybe Yugoslavia, some Slavic
place,
and war-torn.
Right.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about this with Midsommar. There was some criticism for that, but I think a lot of people swept it under the rug because Hostel came on the success of Saw. And at the time when those two films were released, which was like mid-80s time, torture porn was still kind of a really interesting quote-unquote movement per se. I mean, I have objections to it, but Saw definitely started a trend and Hostel kind of capitulated that trend. And he took a lot of pride in that. And the thing, I saw Hostel in bits and pieces, but it's just kind of like, why make this movie? This is just showing you how to kill people in really creative ways. And a lot of the horror fandom, especially in America, is satiated by that. They want to see more extreme films and more extreme films. And I think that is who Eli Roth considers himself the king of, that specific faction of horror fandom. I mean, he even has a podcast on Shudder. So he will keep being insanely popular for always making really nonsensical but offbeat films. But I mean, he did Hostel, then he did Green Inferno, then he did Knock Knock. Have you ever heard of Knock Knock?
No.
Knock Knock is the film with Keanu Reeves, Ana de Armas, and Lorenza Izzo, who is his ex-wife and the lead character in Green Inferno. So it's those three people. And it's essentially about how these two Spanish-speaking immigrants gang up and rape Keanu Reeves for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of like, why?
Yeah.
So I have a lot of problems with Eli Roth. I don't think he should... I personally don't think he should have a job. But I mean, the thing is, he found a niche that in the 21st century has become extremely popular in horror fandom. And even though I think that his influence has kind of been on the decline, especially as people point out more problematic aspects of his filmmaking, and right now in horror fandom, we're trying to become more inclusive. I feel like that is kind of more the trend now. How to do, you know, gay films, how to do black films, how to do films by immigrants that came to America. I feel like that is more the trend now. And I feel like people like Eli Roth are being kind of left behind. But as a result, there's still at least half of, like, I'm sure, like, Shudder's subscribers stay on Shudder just to hear what films this guy sees.
Yeah. Well, I got to jump in because, first of all, I think we disagree about his skills. I thought that Hostel was not my type of movie. All of his horror movies, not my type of movies. I do not like a lot of gore. I wouldn't see it in the theaters because that's too intense for me. But watching it at home, Hostel is kind of a good story. It isn't all torture porn. The torture porn is, you know, really weighted at the end, which I think is Eli Roth's style. He tries to set up this kind of fun, very, oh, you're having a good time, and there's jokes, and then all of a sudden the nightmare comes. So I actually think he, and again, it's another 90 minutes. It wraps up. It has an ending. I think he makes movies. I can see why people are big fans. It's not my style, but it's not just an incoherent, like, torture porn from start to finish. He definitely has range in there, even if a lot of it is objectionable. And there's one other thing I wanted to mention with that. That I actually saw one of his newer movies, which is a kid's movie.
Right.
Yeah.
Tintin.
Right? Oh, well, I'm thinking of A House with a Clock in Its Walls.
I'm sorry. No, you're right. Tintin was Spielberg.
Yeah. So A House with a Clock in Its Walls, I don't remember anything about it specifically, but after I saw it, I thought that was really fun. So I could actually see the things that he does really well apply better to other genres.
Yeah, I mean, I won't lie and say that he's not even charming or entertaining, because every interview I've ever seen of his, he comes off as very likable, like the kind of freak that you got along with in AP history because they also liked Dario Argento films or whatever. But I still don't think he's a competent filmmaker. I really don't, especially when you look at the films that he wrote and directed himself, which for the majority part are all of his horror films. I'm pretty sure The House with the Clock in Its Walls was an adaptation. But his original work, it's always just trying to be subversive, and I'm really over that. I just am. Like, he clearly is not interested in the pathology of anything that he makes a movie about. He just wants to make a fun and gross and subversive film. And as you said, that's
got an audience, you know.
It has a big audience. A very, very big audience. And I think, like I said, Eli Roth is considered their king. Mm-hmm. And I think if those people are even listening to our podcast, you know, they would be offended by me saying that, because they think, a lot of people, I feel, think that Eli Roth is misunderstood. But I think it's interesting that Eli Roth was supposed to be the next, like, horror Spielberg, or, you know, people thought that he was going to be, you know, the next James Wan, because James Wan, you know, did Saw, but then he did The Conjuring, and then The Conjuring turned into Insidious and all of these other things. And Blumhouse has also been able to really blow up in the last 10 years. But where has Eli Roth been in this conversation? He really just kind of has become off to the fringe, where he wants to make his really weird and extreme movies in an atmosphere where I think that's just not as popular anymore. And I think that's why he's kind of regulated to, like, the extreme genre factions, like people that, you know, do everything but just watch everything on Shudder.
But I mean, House with a Clock in Its Walls is a kids movie. You know, I saw that in the theater. Yeah, no, I think that's interesting. That's not fringe. That's not...
No, I think that's interesting. And I would love... I haven't read any interviews for him regarding that, but I would love to know why he did it.
Yeah.
Because that actually came after Green Inferno, I'm pretty sure. And I'm pretty positive Green Inferno was considered, like, his passion project. Like, it's the film that he wanted to make forever. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So, and it didn't have a good reception at all. So I wonder where things lie with him. But I mean, he's always going to be fine. He probably made so much money making Hostel films that it doesn't really matter.
And I do want to throw out too, in defense of people who like his movies, I want to make sure we're not purists here, and like you have to like smart movies. You can't like stupid movies or movies that are, you know, X, Y, and Z. Because that's me. You know, I like movies that are like trash and like, ugh, and I'm like, this is bad for X, Y, and Z reason. I hope that we're inclusive to both Eli Roth's fans and Eli Roth's haters.
Well, I think that it's not that he makes bad films, because we definitely are a champion for all different types of films. I just think that when you make films with the purpose to offend especially marginalized groups, which is something that he did with Green Inferno and something that he implies with Knock Knock, then you have a problem. And I have a problem with him as a filmmaker and him as a person. And if you really like Eli Roth films, I'm kind of don't even want to be your friend, because that kind of weirds me out. I don't understand what attracts people to such degradation. And I like all different types of films, but you know, it's there for someone, and his popularity for sure. I even wanted to listen to his podcast, because even though I don't like his films, I always like the way that he talks about films. I really do. He used to be really famous for going on online forums and catfishing underage girls, actually. He's a creep. But this was like 2007, 2008, 2009. I know I was in high school because I was really excited about the prospect of like talking to Eli Roth. But just looking back on it,
Did you ever talk to him online?
I read his comments, but I didn't specifically talk to him. I did know people that FaceTimed him and sent him nudes. I don't know. I think that he, like I said, is one end of the spectrum where this is where having kind of like a fetish for exotic stories and then thinking that you can do them really backfires. And I don't think he'll ever change because he's like 50 now and really set in his ways. But you never know. I think it would be great if he would make a film that I would be interested in watching, because I do agree that he is a witty person, but I don't think he's an empathetic person, and that really turns me off.
Gotcha.
Alrighty. Are you ready for Eyes of My Mother?
Yes.
Alright.
I don't do this very often.
Do what?
Go home with people.
Neither do I.
Your house is so neat.
Thank you.
Is this your mother?
Yes.
What did she do?
She was a surgeon in Portugal.
What kind?
Eyes. We used to do the sections together.
What happened to her?
I remember I was fascinated by how the inside of the body looked. She always hoped I would be a surgeon one day.
Okay, and that was a bit of Eyes of My Mother, which was directed by Nicolas Pesch and released in 2016. And yeah, this is my favorite of the three films that we're talking about today. I love it because it was just something that I wasn't expecting. It's a black and white film. And it kind of embodies the monstrous feminine more than any of the other tropes. And after I watched it, I even wasn't sure if I liked it, per se. But
yeah, I saw some other reviews that people had written that were similar. They were like, I gotta think about this.
Yeah, because the one thing, the couple interesting stylistic bits about it is that it's shot in black and white, and this is something that Nicolas said that he thought that he was going to get a lot of pushback on, but A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night got big the year before this was released. Well, it helped him kind of pave a way. Like, it wasn't the first black and white horror film
that did so well. It wasn't a downer. It wasn't like, someone beat me to it.
He thought that, if anything, it made his film stronger. It didn't make it seem like it was such an anomaly.
Gotcha.
And he specifically wanted to do it in black and white because he was really inspired by Hitchcock and by Twilight Zone, he specifically, well, he doesn't, but he agreed with a reviewer that said that it's kind of like Hitchcock meets a Texas Chainsaw Massacre, which I kind of get it, because one thing that I am most surprised by this film is how gory it is. But the other thing,
even in black and white,
right? And but the thing that's most interesting about it is just how quiet it is, because especially with films like Green Inferno, Hostel, and even a bit like Midsommar, you're really driven by visual cues to tell you when something shocking is happening. But Eyes of My Mother doesn't really go that route. Things just happen, and I had to rewind a lot of the movie to go back and actually realize, oh, that's what happened. Because a lot of really, really gruesome stuff happens, and a lot of really, really gruesome stuff happens at the hand of this beautiful Portuguese girl.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it's set, in Portugal.
So that's the interesting thing about this film. When I suggested it, I thought that it was set in Portugal, but as it's mostly a character study, which is kind of weird, but as more people got introduced, which there are only about like four other characters in the film and they actually die pretty quickly, I think they're all American. And
so, can I pause you one second?
Portuguese.
So they're all American. She's just Portuguese. Sorry. So I didn't get to see this one because I was too busy watching all the Eli Roth movies, the entire Eli Roth collection. But so they die really quickly, and then it's just her.
Right, because it is about a young woman whose mother was murdered right in front of her by a stranger, and the whole film is kind of her way of coping with it. And as a result, she's kind of like this desensitized, really lonely, really sad woman that keeps bringing people home, either encountering, because it's on a big farm, mm-hmm. either encountering them, or at one point she picks up a girl from a bar and takes her home. Mm-hmm. But everyone does die pretty quickly once they feel like something is off with her, because even though she presents very normal, she's very quiet, and it's usually like a slow realization with everyone that something is wrong with her. But yeah, the family itself is Portuguese, but everyone else seems to be American.
Uh-huh. And that's not exploited. It's not like, oh, well, this weird Portuguese.
Well, that's why it took me some time to sit with it, to really feel how I felt like about it. Because just reading his name, I was like, well, maybe he's Portuguese.
Yeah.
And then when I did more research, you know, he's just this Italian immigrant. And so something that I always ask with these films is, why are you introducing that element then? And like with Eli Roth, you know, a lot of it is exoticism, and a lot of it is the fact that he doesn't think that criticisms against him about films being problematic don't apply to him.
Right. He just wants to have a good old time.
Right.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know Nicholas's reasoning, and he said that he actually didn't start the film or write the film with that intention. He was a music video director before, and he had worked with the actress, which I'm not going to pronounce her name, but the actress in it is amazing. I think this is the only film she's ever done.
Yeah.
And when he met the actress, she could barely speak English. And when he had already had this idea of this really lonely girl that is isolated from everyone and kind of kills as a coping mechanism, he already had this idea in mind. And when he met kind of the perfect actress for it, then he wrote it with her in mind. And she wrote all of her own parts in Portuguese. He doesn't understand Portuguese. So he even said that oftentimes he would tell her to say something similar to this, and she would say a different thing instead, and she would tell him what she said. And mm-hmm. he specifically said that it was a way of introducing a superficial barrier. That way she is literally hard to understand. So she is figuratively hard to understand because she has this hyperviolent nature that is never really fully explained. And then there's this language barrier that she has with everyone she's ever met ever since she was a kid. So I thought that was really interesting. I feel like, you know, he said that he was highly influenced by Japanese and French horror. And he said that he would watch those films without subtitles. So he wanted to make a film where it felt similar, that you could watch it without subtitles
and just still get some, feed the fully. Feelings of the story, right. Or the emotions. Or,
right.
So how does he keep this from being a story of a dangerous immigrant who kills everybody?
The thing is, nothing is ever explained, because that's actually, again, where a lot of the viewers' confusion comes from. It's kind of like, why is this foreign family have this farm in assumingly America, but maybe it's not America. But
yeah, I mean, you saw it and you weren't even sure. It wasn't like a real obvious.
Yeah, nothing is ever fully explained. And he said that he actually has a lot of clues in the film as to why it is set the way that it is set, but he doesn't want to explain it. And I kind of really respect that, because I agree that nothing in the film is fully ever explained. Like, I had to, again, rewatch a lot of things. Even the mom's murder was off screen, and I had to, like, double check that that's what was going on. And I think, you know, I think it's very difficult not to make films influenced by things that are non-American. Like, I think that, especially if you're creative and you like films, you're going to like all different types of films. So I definitely don't want to get into this podcast saying that Americans should only make films about Americans, but it's all about doing it with respect, or with the hindsight of respect. And I actually think he really pulled it off here, because nothing ever felt fetishized, probably because nothing was ever fully explained, because he just made a film about a character and you have 2 hours to understand that character, and you either understand or you don't.
Yeah, he must have some good instincts, because I could also see someone just totally effing that up, right?
Right. I mean, somebody, like, if just, you think about Eli Roth, you right. know, there would
be, he probably like this, couldn't hit, every time he right. throws the dart, he's probably hitting the board for like, wrong, no. Like,
well, one thing about Eli Roth is he makes loud movies.
Yeah.
He makes super loud movies. And I'm not talking about literally. I'm just saying that there a lot of things happen just to happen. They're subversive. And Eyes of My Mother is probably one of the quietest horror movies I've ever seen. Like, ever. There's not...
But there is still gore, right?
Yeah, there is gore. And the thing that there's a lot of gore, actually, and a lot of kind of creative gore.
Yeah, in a way. Like black and white. I feel like you have to be,
right.
You can be even more intense, but you have to be creative.
And the interesting thing is a lot of it wasn't on screen. A lot of it was on screen, but a lot of it wasn't on screen. And you would just see the character putting away bags into the refrigerator. And you would have to think, wait, what was the scene before? So he really relied heavily on the Kuleshov effect, which the Kuleshov effect is when you – it is the Kuleshov effect describes a relationship when you see two different shots together. So, for example, if you see a shot of a man and then you see a shot of an apple, what do you assume?
Adam's apple.
What do you assume about the man?
Oh, Adam and Eve.
Just a shot of a man and a shot of an apple.
He's in New York.
It makes you assume that he's hungry, correct?
Oh.
Right, because you see the man, you see the apple. Now, say that you see a shot of a man and then you see a shot of a baby. What do you assume?
He's a father.
Exactly. And this film, probably more than any film I've seen in recent history, really relies on that effect, because you'll see
to explain things. Yeah.
I need to rewatch it probably, but I don't remember like a full scene of violence. A lot of times we would cut right into the middle of the violence, or we see the beginnings of the violence and then it would just end. And then the next shot you would see is the girl putting away
the bloodless leftovers.
bloodless bags in the refrigerator, and you're like, oh, she must have completely murdered them and chopped them up and put them in the refrigerator. But that's never explained. And since she spends most of the film alone, it's all about orienting yourself. And so this one kind of broke my own rules because I wanted to look at films that looked at foreign lands, but I decided to keep it because I still think the foreign aspect is something that's really important here, and I think is treated with a lot of respect, especially when considering the foreign aspect is, in a way, the villainous aspect. But I think one thing that's different between this and Midsommar and Green Inferno and Hostel is that it's not because these people are foreign that is why they're abject. It's just, you know, it's just another part of her abjection. And I think that that is something that a lot of American filmmakers mess up, is that they think that because people are foreign, we're going to ascribe abjection to them, when that's pretty much casual racism. So yeah, interesting.
So who would you recommend this movie for?
I recommend this film to everyone, honestly.
Yeah.
I think even if you're not a huge fan of gore, since it's black and white, it kind of is able to be handled better. And it feels like a slower film, but it actually really isn't. Like, a lot just happens.
Yeah, I think this one was also like 90 minutes around that mark, right?
And one thing that I really liked is he said, like, there's a lot of children in the film, and it would make me nervous, but he himself said that he views children kind of as sacred. And so he wanted to make sure that none of the children were specifically harmed, but the children do experience a lot of trauma. And I'm really impressed. I was so impressed, actually, that it makes me want to watch The Grudge. And I even know that The Grudge is supposed to be like a really gory version, a really gory update of the original. And I think it's really interesting that he said that he's most inspired by Japanese and French horror, and then he got The Grudge remake. So I'm sure that was probably a dream.
Oh, wow. Because that's actually interesting you mentioned that, because I was thinking of the American remake Grudge. And so I was thinking he was remaking the American, but no, he's remaking the Japanese.
So the original Grudge that came out with Sarah Michelle Gellar was actually a remake of the Japanese version. It's set, and that actually could have been useful for one of ours. Podcast.
Because that one's all about,
it's set American characters in Japan.
Yeah.
But this Grudge just brought it all to America.
To America. Okay.
So it's different in that sense, but and John Cho stars in it, so that's also amazing. I think it's great that he casts very well. He casts very well, and he doesn't seem to cast, you know, for fetishism, unlike Eli Roth.
Yeah. Who literally casts a woman that he then marries. I think they're getting divorced. You might not be the only one who doesn't like Eli Roth.
No, yeah.
I would love
to speak to her.
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine it was a happy marriage.
Yeah.
Anyways.
So the new, and that new Grudge is out, coming out soon.
Comes out today.
Wow.
Yeah. But I don't know if I'll see
it. Has there been any reception?
I haven't paid attention. I'm sure that probably the embargo is up today, actually. But I don't know. I just think it's a problem, you know, remaking The Grudge again anyway. But I really might try and see it. I don't know.
Cool.
And I have no faith whenever things are dumped in January, since January is considered the graveyard.
Really? That's where you throw it if it's just like didn't pan out the way you wanted it to?
Yeah, usually when films are dumped in January is because people don't, that's when box office receipts are lowest. So that is when studios will lose the least amount of money, per se.
Because you're not up against the heavy hitters.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, if you look back and think traditionally back on every January release, for the most part, they've all been horrible. I can't even think of a January release
that was successful. I think things don't really start heating up in movie world until March. Usually that's considered like when more blockbusters begin to be released. That's the beginning of the season. And then April, I think, is the official. I mean, usually the first weekend of May, we get an Avengers film. I think that happened last time. Like May 3rd, 2019 was when Avengers was released, I'm pretty sure.
God bless America.
So yeah. Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see. I definitely might see it. I might not, though. I don't know.
Cool. We got to bring it back to the pod. Let us know what you think.
Sure. All right. Are we ready for the last one?
Yes. Let's do it.
I told you that I want to go to that festival in Sweden.
No, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided to do it.
I don't mind you going. I just wish you would have told me. That's all.
Dude, she needs a therapist. You've been wanting out of this stupid relationship for like a year now.
And don't forget about all of the beautiful Swedish women you'll meet in June.
Okay, guys.
That's not her again. Seriously?
Babe, what's happening? Danny.
I was so very sorry to hear about what happened.
I'm sorry.
I invited Danny to come to Sweden.
You know what she's been going through?
Christian says you've got this special week planned.
It's sort of a crazy festival. Special ceremonies and dressing up.
That sounds fun.
Unbelievable.
Welcome and happy midsummer. Skål!
What time is it?
9 p.m.
That can't be right. The sky is blue.
This is what 9 p.m. is like here.
How long have you two been together?
Just over 3.5 years.
4 years.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's like another world.
Tomorrow's a big day.
Is it scary?
What is it?
It has special properties.
What am I going through?
We just need to acclimate.
I don't want to acclimate. I want to go.
Absolutely not.
What's happening? I don't know why you invited us.
That's why you look so guilty right now, because you know.
We only do this every 90 years. I was most excited for you to come.
And that was A Bit of Midsummer, directed by Ari Aster. It came out last year, July 5th of 2019. Only remember because I wanted to see it after July 4th.
Why? What happened on July 4th?
July, fireworks. I don't know. I think we hung out, but I remember we were going to see it the day after Independence Day. And then we didn't.
I think I probably had something happen.
Yeah.
But then we both saw it about a week or so away from each other.
Yeah, we saw it within. Yeah. Yeah. So I think we might have even given an unofficial review, but I don't
know. Yeah, really back remember. In the day, we probably said a few words.
Yeah. But, you know.
Or not. It might have been one of those weird in between times where we didn't record for a bit.
Yeah, maybe. So. Yeah, so we're going to talk about it. And technically, it's the one that inspired this podcast, especially within the last few months. I've been getting a lot of questions as to why Midsummer doesn't count as a foreign horror film.
Because it's fake.
Basically. And I kind of want to talk about a different perspective that I think a lot of people don't talk about it. So, right. You didn't like Midsummer.
I didn't.
No.
For the listener, do you mind summarizing a little bit? I'm really bad at summarizing.
No, yeah. I mean, I feel it's like Midsummer is kind of known now as kind of like the breakup horror film. And in breakup a way, it's horror, kind of yeah. like exactly that. It's about this college student that played by Florence Pugh or Puff. I always forget how she pronounces her name.
She's awesome.
She's great. And she had her banner year yesterday. She was in like five yesterday, last year. She was in like five different films. Most recently, Little Women, which cool. has been doing well.
Yeah.
Horsperia,
we support Little Women.
I don't support Little Women. Oh, damn it. Sorry. The studio blacklisted Latino critics from it. Latino women.
What?
So wow. Little Women can go fuck itself and Greta Gerwig can go fuck itself.
Do you know any other, what's that?
I don't want to say to be fair because this isn't fair.
Yeah.
A lot of studios will say that. Will not screen films in advance for Latino critics because they or Latinx critics, sorry, for Latinx critics because they say that this isn't the target audience for the film. And that is what someone and this was a Latina woman. A Latina woman wanted to see Little Women in advance. That way she could write about it for her Latino newspaper. Mm-hmm. And she was rejected from Sony, saying, wow. Sorry, but we're not screening this in advance for the Latinx audience because it's not our core audience. And honestly, fuck that. I don't care about Greta Gerwig at all. I like a lot of people in that film, but I have no interest in yet another Little Women adaptation. And if you like it, that's great. I hear that, especially with a young white woman, it resonates a lot. And I think that that's great. But I am not supporting it whatsoever. All right.
Her spirit does not support Little Women. No. Correction.
But Florence is cool. Florence is definitely a gifted actress.
Yeah. She kicks ass in this movie. I don't like the movie, but I still love thinking about like all the memes that have been made of the images. Yeah. I'm like, ooh, she was so good.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think I didn't like this movie either, but I do think... You know, the meme potential is funny. I do think it's... Ari Aster, I have a problem with all of his films, actually. Uh-huh. I think that they're really goofy, and I think that they're really undercooked, which I'm probably the only person in the world that thinks that. But I think he definitely knows how to make memorable films, because even though we don't like it, I do think that it definitely has contributed enough to the cultural zeitgeist that we're always going to know what this guy is going to do next. And that's interesting.
And for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a breakup horror. It's like this couple goes on a trip to Sweden, right?
So what Midsommar specifically is about, and this is probably the film more than Green Inferno, more than Hostel, more than Eyes of My Mother, where the culture is hyper important per se. You know, it's very much Midsummer Festival or Midsummer Solstice is highly important to Swedish culture. It is one of their happiest times. It is, I would say sacred, but a lot of them do view it as like a time to just like hang out and do stuff. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of research on Swedish people talking about Midsommar. And
yeah. So I got a question, because in the movie, everyone is, it almost seems like tribal, like these native Swedish people, but maybe not. We don't get to see like big buildings and modern. So is it a modern holiday too for everybody, or is it a more
it's a pre-pagan holiday, and this is again where the problematicness begins to brew, because in general, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, of course, these college students, that the reason why they want to go is because their friend is a Swedish exchange student. He specifically comes from a tribe, I think the Halta, something like that. And he said, hey, you know, come along with me. It'll be great. And at first, her boyfriend doesn't want to invite her. And then he accidentally mentions it. And then he's forced to invite her because her family just was murdered in a murder-suicide. And she is the only survivor of that. So, you know, there's like a lot of different layers going on. But the assumption the movie wants to give you is that there exists these tribes. Ari Aster himself specifically says that he doesn't like the tribe being referred to as a cult. He says that he never looked at it as a cult and he doesn't view them as a cult. He wanted them to be very warm, very colorful, very friendly. He actually compared the film Midsommar to a Disney film where like it starts off with this hyper traumatic thing and then these colorful flourishes happen as a result. So, you know, that's the world that Ari Aster wants you to believe. But the fact of the matter is that Midsommar isn't like that.
Yeah. And to what he's saying about a cult, I mean, cults can be warm and friendly and that's how they get members, right? They're like overly friendly and like uncomfortably warm.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the problem with this film. It's problematic, but it's like problematic with intention. It's like this guy that had a really good idea of what he wanted to do and then thought that he was making the progressive choices, but again, he didn't even understand the intent of those choices. So it's kind of like, you know, Ari Aster is absolutely intelligent and very well read. Like he said that he did so much research for this film. You know, he started the research where the film takes place, which is in a place in Sweden called Hälsingland. But he even said himself that he copped a lot of the Swedish traditions between a blend of reading up on Swedish, Germanic, and English traditions. And he himself doesn't even feel comfortable saying that the how do I say, the cult rules, I guess, in the film are purely Swedish. He says that they're a mixture of all of these different things.
I mean, that it's funny because you can put in so much work and put in so much care into your craft, but still miss the obvious picture that your entire premise is fundamentally flawed. And I'm not trying to like find something wrong with it. I couldn't help but think while I was watching it, like, well, what if this was just Africa? This would be completely unacceptable.
And I think he even tries to subvert that in a way with the character, and I forget his name, but Shitty from The Good Place.
Oh, right.
He is.
There's one black actor character in the film.
Yeah. And even with the inclusion of that character,
who might be the most civilized because he's like an anthropologist. He knows so much.
He's subverting the trope of like either the black character that dies first or the dumb character or the magical character. But the problem is he doesn't even understand the racial implications of that himself.
Right. And it's kind obvious. And he's not a likable character.
He's not. And not that, you know, I definitely don't think, hey, you know, put people of color in your film, they all have to be likable. It's a fine line, but the thing that really gets to me and makes it so obvious to me that this was written by a white man is in one scene, the like cult leader is speaking, he's like the elder, is speaking to Shitty's character. And he's saying, you know, this is our sacred book. You can look at it, you can study it for your PhD project, but please, please, please don't let it leave this room. Don't take it.
Yeah.
Don't do anything like that. And then, of course, he takes it.
Yeah.
And I find it highly unbelievable that a very well-educated black scholar, PhD candidate, doing intense research on that, would just completely lack the empathy.
Yeah.
And he does the
kind of more historical white guy thing, which is trample on the cultural rules, the cultural significance, and just say my way is the way that we're doing it now.
And that bothers me because I'm not. I also don't want to get into this like weird dichotomy that, oh yes, all people of this race are good or whatever. But I do think that people don't understand that that is a stereotype, the white people trampling on it, because white people have always been entitled, right? So to me, my question when watching that scene is, where did this dude becomes so entitled? Where did he miss this cultural, like, sure, it's very possible, you know, there could be a million explanations to that, and they could be valid, but in general, to me, it felt like Ari Aster was just wanting to write an unexpected stereotype, right?
Yeah.
And so,
but he's like, but he's not going to be, he's also going to be kind of a villain.
Exactly, exactly.
Which and, is like, well,
and that's so like it didn't make any sense.
For the sense of just what, like shitting on the guy?
No, and he makes the guy have empathy towards Florence Pugh's character. Earlier in the film, and this is where again you can tell that he was almost writing to a book, saying, oh, I know this is problematic, so I'm going to do this instead, but he doesn't understand the emotional empathy. He was really focused on the relationship. And I think one thing that I think was really interesting that he said is he said that he thinks that the boys in Midsommar are in a different movie than
the women?
Florence Pugh. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He thinks that, I always forget her name. She has a really, I know the guy's name is Christian, but I forget her name. The main character's name, he thinks that she has, she's in a completely different movie, per se. Okay.
Yeah, I like some parts of this movie. I like her, the tension, the building, the shitty boyfriend. It's always, as somebody, as a man who's 35 years old, I've been the shitty boyfriend before. So it's always kind of, there's something satisfying about seeing the shittiness that hasn't been shown maybe in those exact ways, and be like, oh my god, yes, so shitty, like either me or my friends, we've done that, that's so bad,
right?
And here's this oblivious character. There are things I like about this movie, but when I saw this movie, I was actually living with a roommate. One of my roommates was Swedish, like from Sweden, just here for maybe a year. And when I saw the movie, I said, I just saw that movie Midsommar. And I immediately felt like, like he knew what I was talking about. I knew what he was talking about. Like I knew it was just this awkwardness of like that movie that made your people look like freaking weirdos.
Yeah.
And then if you know, the horror stuff.
Right. And so for
me, it was weird. It was weird.
Prepping for this episode, I really wanted to delve deep into what the Swedish response was, because the only real experience I had with it before is a really famous Swedish songwriter was asked about it recently, and she was like, yeah, it's kind of weird that like this goofy kind of ritual became a horror film, but and I was like, well, I wonder what other people think about it.
So her response, or their response, was kind of
just kind of in general. That's the first, that's like the blanket reaction I feel, because I did like googling before, and it just seems like Swedish people in general are just kind of confused as to how it could be a horror, per se, because Midsommar is such like a happy, non-nefarious time.
Yeah.
It
would be like, I mean, would it be like us doing a Christmas horror?
I guess, in a way.
But it's more Christmas specific. Yeah.
I guess it's more maybe an Easter horror.
Yeah.
Something like that. Okay. Like something, it's just this, Midsommar is just the celebration of the summer solstice. And Sweden gets really hyped for it. You know, they go out camping and stuff like that. The rituals that were described in the film are completely made up. They don't exist, like Ari Aster himself. I mean, they exist in forms of many different traditions.
Yeah, but I'm sure he researched and
he
took himself from he blends something,
he didn't even want to directly state which ones he blended, because he quote unquote has a lot of respect for them,
right?
Okay.
And actually I believe him.
No,
it just doesn't
do.
Always come across when you have like the sex tent, where you have what seems like a 10-minute familial sex scene,
I, you know, it's weird. I like Ari Aster more than I like Robert Eggers, I would say. I think he kind of makes more accessible films, even though I kind of like the fact that Robert Eggers just makes really weird movies, and I don't like most of them, but, you know.
What's a couple Eggers movies?
He's your favorite.
The Witch and The Lighthouse.
Oh, so, yeah, love that.
You know, he definitely is a very singular version. And I think Ari Aster's films are a little bit more accessible, especially in a horror way. Like, I don't think a lot, say, you know, we were talking about the Shudder fandom. I don't think the Shudder fandom are quivering in their boots over The Lighthouse, whereas a lot of the Shudder fandom might like Hereditary and Midsommar a lot more. But I think, well, going back to the Swedish response, a lot of them were just really, like, confused, because a lot of them...
Do you think these are people that saw the movie? Or
yeah, these are all people that saw the movie. Okay. I looked now at critics rather than just, you know, looking online on social media. I wanted to know the official critical response. And a lot of them thought, you know, it was a well-done film, but it's just kind of like, why adulterate the nicest thing that we have? Like, a lot of them were just more confused. They actually said, literally in one review, they said, it's just weird to essentially make a cannibal holocaust for Midsommar. Right, like, that's right. It's not a good feeling. And that's actually kind of, in a way, funny, because... you know, we talked about with Green Inferno how Cannibal Holocaust was kind of like the holy grail for that film. And Eli Roth didn't care about how problematic it was to depict brown savages. And now we have Midsommar, you know, kind of depicting this, even though Ari Aster wouldn't agree, you know, depicting this Swedish kind of savagery. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the highbrow Swedish critics didn't really like the implication. And, you know, I'm not about to cry a tear for Sweden per se. Sweden is a great country. They're very privileged. You know, they definitely exist in the upper echelon of the Western world. So a film like Midsommar is probably more fun than anything else. But it, as you said, it's just kind of like when you can replace the... where the film is set and pretty much keep all the same variables, like I did all these research on these Kenyan and Nigerian and Ghanaian tribes, and then I mixed it together, you know. I think that this is one that's completely dead in the center of Eyes of My Mother and Green Inferno. Instead of, you know, kind of developing as it went along, Ari Aster, you know, went to Sweden, got a little bit taste of everything, and then was like, okay, this is a pretty neutral ground, quite literally, and I know the perfect story for it. And it's just kind of like, why?
Yeah.
You know, and I don't feel like he has honestly answered that well enough to my liking. Because a lot of people have asked him, you know, like, why Sweden? He's like, oh, you know, a lot of respect, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And a lot of people like this movie. It was one of the most well-reviewed films of 2019.
Why do you think people liked it?
Because of the breakup angle. Yeah. And
I like that part of it. I did.
Yeah, I think that it was extremely cathartic to a lot of people. Usually when people don't like this film, they say that they don't consider it a horror film. And not the fact, you know, that it seems problematic or anything. Yeah. And to be fair, it is kind of rare that we get really original horror visions. So I also think Ari Aster is kind of riding that wave right now. The same wave that, you know, Robert Eggers is riding. But even Robert Eggers with The Lighthouse, I don't feel like The Lighthouse was as popular as The Witch.
No way. And I don't think it was ever going to be.
I agree. I mean, it's a black and white film with two people in it that speaking gibberish.
Two dudes speaking gibberish, getting mad at each other.
Yeah.
But a couple of things about Midsommar. I thought it was too long. I think it's really...
And he right now has a director's cut, a 3-hour version.
Oh, never. I will never see that.
Everyone says that it's better because it puts more the relationship more into context. But I have no interest, to be quite frank.
Yeah. I think... the movie is funny. It has some jokes, and some of the Swedish otherness is kind of comes off as played for laughs a little bit, which I think is you can't really do that and then also expect the audience to respect the culture like you do when they're doing the sex tent orgy scene and all the moaning is happening, whatever.
That kid that looks like the Toy Story kid, I forgot his name, but you know who I'm talking about.
Does he look like the bully from the Toy Story?
Yeah. Toy Story kid.
And he's a great, he, I think he's a great actor, right? I thought he was good. Or is he funny or something?
He was like the offensive one, okay. Per se. He was like the offensive American, you know, yeah. Like pissing on shit, yeah. And things like that.
He was like, was he the first to die?
I don't know.
Or made you think, that he was going to be the first to die? The couple
was the first to die, right? The one that tried to leave. We didn't see their bodies later, but I think they were the first. Regardless, either way.
The biggest reason I didn't like it as a movie was that I felt the horror scenes, the gore was so over the top, and I don't like gore, so it was hard for me. And it also made me feel like some of it was creative in a way that I felt like I was back in middle school, and the kid scribbling on his notebook just the most disgusting thing you could possibly think of, so the principal gets him and da-da-da-da-da, and then whatever happens next, it felt like it was just almost like elementary school, this is the craziest ish, and I'm gonna make it that way, and that's how it's scary at the end. So for me, that all those were the things that held it back for me. It was the length and that gore that I just turned me off.
Right. If I don't, you know, because when I first saw it, I even wasn't too sure if I disliked or didn't. I had a lot of problems with it, and I still have a lot of problems with it. And I think my main problem with Ari Aster is that he starts films really, that he has really great premises for films, and then they just become goofy.
Yeah.
Like, beyond goofy. Like, I think
Hereditary, that's how I would describe it. You know, became
super goofy in the last 40 minutes of it. Everyone always says Toni Collette deserves an Oscar for it, and I don't know what people are saying.
For Hereditary.
Because it was just so hammy, you know, and it was so unrealistic, and you know, it literally ends in the stupidest way. And Midsommar, I feel like, had a better ending, but kind of getting there was just really goofy. Like, I actually agree that it felt like there were two different films going on, mm-hmm. and for me, it wasn't cohesive. And I think, in a way, and I'm sorry to use this term, but in a way, it felt like a lot of the movie was gaslighting, mm-hmm. and I know a lot of that. Well, in
the
sense of
like the boyfriend gaslighting the girlfriend.
I mean that there's definitely actual gaslighting happening in this film, and maybe that's also why it makes me feel this way. But on top of it just being like completely ridiculous, I feel like people like this film in a way because it is technically done well, but they're not looking at the second meaning behind it. It's mm-hmm. kind of like the Joker. If anything, I feel like this film is almost very thematically similar to the Joker, mm-hmm. where the bells and whistles are there. Like, I get why people like it, and I get why there is an appeal to it. But when you try and strip it all back and actually look at what we're talking about, like we said, horror is a cultural projection of anxieties. What is Midsommar saying other than, shitty relationships other suck? Than,
yeah, right. And
I feel like he could have said that much better in a tighter film, as you said, but also in a film where the characters and their relationships make more sense. I just feel like
if he wanted to do that, he didn't need to be in Sweden at all. I mean, all his horror came from that weird what's gonna happen next.
Yeah And you know,
we don't know these people.
It's just I he is very intentional in saying that it's a respect kind of thing, but I don't think that comes across. Really don't. And I think a lot of people, you know, the debate about Midsommar is, you know, how effective that is, or you know, why that makes it a good film or why it doesn't make it a good film. But I think we just need to have more of a conversation as to, and that's why I wanted to do this podcast. You know, I definitely encourage and want to encourage American filmmakers to look outside of themselves, to, you know, look at different locations, to definitely understand different cultures. A lot of that by watching films from different cultures. But when you decide to make a film and to, you know, make it about a certain culture or set in a specific place, be aware as to what your identity as a filmmaker, brings to that table and why you want to set it in a certain place. Because if you don't have an answer for that, like Eli Roth didn't have an answer for being problematic, and Ari Aster's just kind of like, yeah, I blended everything together, you know, maybe don't do that. You know, it's 2020 now. And I like this new movement towards more conscious horror filmmaking, especially in a genre that is considered, you know, subpar or considered damaging towards women, minorities. I just think we should always be responsible filmmakers and responsible viewers. And bad films are great too.
You're here. You're here. Yes. What do you think about the... I know you've had an experience where someone said, well, this is... Well, what if someone said, this is... I think my script might be problematic to, let's say, Black people. Should I have... Would good advice or bad advice be to that person, get this in front of those people that you think this might be problematic and get their opinion, get their honest opinion? Or is that itself kind of like... Don't traumatize others with your shitty, with your potentially offensive. I don't know. Is that good advice to show this to someone who is of the group you're trying to include in your story?
I literally had this situation when I did Script DC in December. I did a horror panel workshop for Women in Film and TV of DC. And it was a great experience. It was 5 hours where I just droned. I essentially did like a history of horror, talked about what we should be mindful of, blah, blah, blah. And at the end, I had people pitch their projects to me if they wanted to get my input as to things to watch out for. And I had a man pitch, a white man, an older white man, pitch a project where it was George Washington coming back as a zombie and killing all of his slaves. And it was a very awkward experience at first, because when I heard the pitch, I was like, I don't even think this is good. But, you know, I you can't really say that in a workshop. So I wanted to get to the questions of his intent. I was like, well, why this story? And he said, well, you know, George Washington isn't the angel that we think of. And I think it would be funny to see him, you know, to see that exercised by killing all of these slaves. And I was like, okay, but why? And he was like, well, it was very barbaric. And I'm like, so you're going to further that barbarism by showing George Washington kill a bunch of Black people on screen? And he's like, well, you know, it's not really that. And then I was like, well, I have a question for you. Has anyone that's Black read your script? And he's like, well, I sent it to a few people and they didn't get back to me. And I was like, well, that should tell you something. And I'm not saying that I do think that it's a problem, say that you're writing about a certain culture or writing about certain characters, and then immediately you're like, yeah, I'm going to ask the one Black friend I have.
Right,
like,
right. And that's yeah.
Yeah. Your friends or the people that you know that are minorities or of different marginalized groups, they're not your past either way, right?
Right.
But I do think, I mean, if you have a good relationship, if it's a genuine relationship that you're just asking because they're your friend, I think that that is great. But in general, I would always just tell people, you know, do your reading, you know, look at books like This Is Why I Don't Talk About White People and I Don't Talk to White People About Race. That's a really great book.
Do you know who that's written by? Because I never forgot. Heard that. That sounds really
I forgot. But that and I'm sorry because it's an amazing author. It's an amazing book.
Yeah. Look it up. It's out there.
Yeah. You know, I think it all comes from a place of conscious stature of your privilege in society. Like I have, even though I'm a brown gay woman, I definitely still have certain privileges, you know. And if I were to write, say, a story about a transgender woman per se, that's not an experience I have. I would be sure to do all of the research. And if I felt like I was in a comfortable relationship with another person like that, then maybe I would ask them to give me some feedback.
Yeah,
but in general, now it's 2020, you know, you just be more responsible, you know, not only as a person but as a creative.
Yeah, and maybe that should be part of your research anyways, just
right
finding people in that group,
right,
and just one on and cultivating relationships so that they could give you feedback along the way, so you don't make the whole thing without the feedback of the people who are going to be impacted by your work.
Right. And I mean, if you're...
by your representation.
Right. And if you're making a film about something and you're trying to represent something, but you personally haven't had any interactions with said people of these identities, then that's also a problem. Mm-hmm. You know?
Unless maybe you took like a trip to Sweden, you had like a really weird time.
It's just really weird. But I think that this was a really interesting study, and these aren't the only films that do it. You know, Hostel does it. The Grudge might be interesting.
Sarah Michelle Gellar.
I think that one might have been an interesting one to look at.
Is there like a big historical? Has this happened a lot in the past? Like, I actually have never seen Cannibal Holocaust.
Well, it happened. I feel like it happened more often when exploitation cinema was more of a thing. Zombie films in and of themselves started with racism and Haitian hatred, essentially. You know, all of the zombie, like, you know, we had white zombie, everything up until, I want to say, like, up until Night of the Living Dead, it was all based on voodoo magic and things like that.
Okay, yeah.
So Cannibal Holocaust was in the 80s. I think Americans are always going to be obsessed with fetishization, even a little bit more so than European counterparts, because, like I said in the beginning, we're considered this cultural melting pot. We kind of have, and our biggest export is movies, period. You know, Hollywood is the shining jewel of America, other than probably war. So there's always going to be that present in films, especially horror films, but you know, it's all about how you choose to do it and what you're really trying to say. Unless you're just like Eli Roth that just wants to make a crazy film just to make a crazy film, and then, you know, that's why I don't like Eli Roth's work, because it doesn't seem intentional.
As you mentioned, the time for an Eli Roth to be successful may be gone.
Yeah.
I don't even think Eli Roth can make an Eli Roth movie. Well,
it'll be interesting.
I wouldn't go that far. I don't think someone else could come in, make a movie as culturally as insensitive as Green. No one, I hope, that makes a movie as insensitive as Green Inferno can make it right now. I hope.
You know what's funny? The only thing that I feel like I ever liked of that he did was the Grindhouse trailer Thanksgiving. And I actually think if he ever decides to make that film, that actually might be an interesting film to watch. And it's funny because that is just a horror film set at Thanksgiving. And I'm like, Eli Roth, I feel like that's exactly what you should do. I feel like, because there hasn't been a really great Thanksgiving horror film, I feel like if you focus, it could be really great. You know what's funny? I actually haven't seen Cabin Fever. Cabin Fever was his first film.
Oh, yes.
And that was set in America.
Yeah.
But it was like his only one.
Yeah. He should probably stick to appropriating bad American holidays.
Yeah. No, really. Yeah. I think the Thanksgiving trailer, which is like 2 minutes long, is easily the greatest thing he has ever done.
The same or different from, there was like a trailer in Inglourious Basterds. You know what I'm talking about?
I think it is the same one.
Okay.
He did a longer version for Inglourious Basterds, I just remembered, that's how I got into him, or that's how I knew of him at first, when I was, I was 16 in 2001. I was a big Quentin Tarantino fan, and Tarantino is the one that kind of brought Eli Roth up. And, you know, if we're looking at Quentin Tarantino,
he produced Hostel.
Yes, you're absolutely right. He produced Hostel.
He probably sees Eli Roth and goes, yeah, man.
No, yeah. No, literally.
Check out the script for Django Unchained.
No, they're very much similar in intent, and I think that that's the problem. Like, I haven't seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood because Quentin Tarantino's comments on Bruce Lee's family really bug me.
Yeah.
And I don't have space in my world anymore to look at Quentin Tarantino and think, yes, his films are necessary, because I don't think that they are necessary.
Yeah.
I think that he makes really well-crafted films. Mm-hmm. And I do think that there is a bigger meaning to them, but the steps from Quentin Tarantino and Eli Roth are much shorter right. than most people want to talk about.
Yeah.
In a way that I think it's almost kind of weird. I think there was more conversation about it back when Hostel was a big thing, but since Eli Roth has kind of fallen off, I think a lot of people have just kind of archived that in the back of our minds. Like, I really had to think about it right now. Like, who is the guy? And it was Quentin.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. You know, be more conscious. I'm really excited to see what this decade of horror brings.
And ooh, I think, yes, 2020.
I think that there will be a lot of really interesting things coming up on the horizon. Like, Antebellum looks really good. So.
Oh, yeah? I think I saw a trailer for that.
Yeah, Janelle Monáe.
Oh, no, I did not. It's a horror?
It's a horror set in antebellum times starring Janelle Monáe.
So, any other, do we get any other details from the trailer?
It was a long time ago that I saw it, but I know it's coming out in the next few months. Mm. I like the way that things are going. And even I feel like Ari Aster has a good film in him, but what worries me is that so many people are on his jock strap right now.
Right.
That
but he's going to make an even more.
Yeah, he's going to just double down on the problems Midsommar and Hereditary have.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, going outside. But we'll see. I have hope, other than Eli Roth, I have hope for Nicholas and for Ari. But I'm also really more interested in films not made by white men. So
Right. Same. My criticism with Midsommar can really be wrapped back into I'd rather see a movie either made by a Swedish person or made by a woman, you know, this the breakup narrative.
Yeah, actually, if I have to say, my biggest problem with Midsommar is actually the way that character is written.
The woman, the lead?
Yeah. God, I forgot her name. Man. Yeah, the way that she's written feels really disconnected to me. And even though, you know, I definitely don't think she's ever made out to be the villain per se, like you're definitely watching her movie, and Ari definitely wrote with a lot of empathy towards her, I think that it also is just clear, I would bet that he didn't let a woman completely revise his script. I absolutely believe that he wrote the script. He's very protective of the script. He might have asked for script notes, but I think that script could have done really good with a hardcore revision by a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can we say generally that if you're going to make a movie in a foreign setting, don't, because the stories are better told by those people? Can we say that?
I don't know. I think... Because I understand the fact, and I kind of hate saying this, but I also understand why people sometimes are like, I get this so often, especially in school, they're like, oh, well, you know, I'm a white man, so you're saying I can't make stories about white men?
Yeah, how limiting. I can't make any story.
Yeah. Or like, oh, I'm now, you know, I think it definitely fuels this weird Trumpian, oh, we're the ones that are being subjugated.
Right.
So I definitely don't want to say, like, don't ever, but like I said with everything else, another really good example from that workshop is I had that guy pitch his George Washington script. I shot it down. It was embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Then I had this other guy pitch the script set in Puerto Rico.
Uh-huh.
On this compound.
And was he Puerto Rican?
No, he was not. He was a white man. On this compound, and this was during a hurricane. At first, he said Hurricane Maria, and I said, don't do Hurricane Maria unless you're going to really get into the historical implications of it. And he took that suggestion. He was like, okay, you're right. It doesn't have to be Hurricane Maria. You see, just doing that, and that was off of a one-minute conversation.
Yeah.
But I kept asking, like, who are the protagonists? Who are we focusing on? And he was like, no, this film, the intent of this film is showing how all of these expatriates have exploited Puerto Rico.
Okay.
And that actually might be a script. I never saw the full script, but just hearing him talk through it and through the intention and his willingness to change things that could be problematic, I think that he was right on track, you know, towards something interesting, towards something intentional. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just, if you do want to set it outside anywhere else, it's just like anything. One of the first things you get to when you get to film school is always write what you know, right? And if you don't know these things, then you need to do the you need to do research just like it was a PhD project, because you're now trying to write in this world. I saw Uncut Gems over the holiday season, and it's probably my favorite film in the last 5 years.
Wow.
But I read a bunch of interviews after I saw it.
Yeah.
And what I really love that the Safdie brothers say is that they write a character biography for everyone in the film, because it is all about their reactions to things. Like, how does someone react to the door being open in the middle of the night? That's going to be different to someone else because of other things.
Right, right.
And that much is very much true in any kind of film, because Uncut Gems isn't a horror film. I would argue it is a horror film.
Ooh,
but,
really?
You know, it's different for every single thing that you're talking about. So that's why, in a way, I kind of stepped away from making films, at least for now, because the amount of detailed work that you have to do to really make something intentional and good and great, people just don't have the time to do. And Uncut Gems itself was made over 10 years.
Wow.
You know?
Really?
Yeah. So, wow. You know, I think that goes for anything else. And that's not to discourage anyone. It's just, you know, good filmmaking takes time.
Yes.
And that's why sometimes it is easier just to write what you know, because when you write with 28, 35, 18 years of experience doing something that feels really personal to you, then you don't need to think about it too hard. You know, it just comes as second nature. But when you're trying to branch out, which I always encourage everyone that's a filmmaker or a writer, you know, definitely branch out. You have to understand that your job is to do the work required to make it good. And
for the horror genre too, I'll just add,
yeah,
you might need to do a little extra, because
yeah.
This might be the genre that you're most likely going to
mess it up,
screw something
right.
up. Or, yeah. Or as opposed to if you make like, well, some kind of feel good, a rom-com, yeah. or something else.
To be fair, that's essentially where I have found a career, you know, trying to tell people that there's actually this really intense social context running alongside all of it. And if you're not intuitive to that while you're writing, that's because horror, I think the horror genre is viewed as subpar because there are so many rules to it. Whereas a drama is a drama, a comedy, I mean, I actually think comedy is the hardest to write for, because being funny,
right,
it, you know, takes a lot of skill,
and then you get
But comedy,
the actors have to be funny, then
right.
the script has to be also good.
Yeah, you really can't do a comedy that's all dark, because if you do a dark comedy, then that becomes something else. So, you know, there's a lot of rules. So that's why comedy and horror, especially, you need to know your rules. You know, it's not just like a thriller or a drama or a documentary. You know, you can essentially, I always love experimentation, but experiment with intent. Don't just write things just because you know you can write them. That's essentially what Eli Roth does, and that's why I really don't like his films.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Back to the heart.
Right, yeah. So this will be going up within the next few weeks. It is our first. We'll be doing a couple of episodes within the next few months.
This is our first of the new year, you were going to say?
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. A big shout out to our listener Charlie, who has been contacting us, giving us advice for future episodes. It's always great to feel like there's someone out there that we don't know that's listening. That's
yes, and Charlie is also the code name for marijuana that we use when we want to talk about it in public, but we don't want to let people know we're talking about marijuana.
That's fair. And yeah, no. And so.
So thanks, next, Charlie.
Yeah, thanks, Charlie. But also, he suggested that we do an episode on films that are so bad that they're good. So that definitely might be coming up. February is Black History Month. Definitely might do Black History there as well. I have a couple new classes this semester as well. So if y'all are listening, probably tie in some episodes to lectures, but in general, just really happy that you're listening. This season, our audio equipment is on the up. We're doing well.
Hope you hear the difference.
Crisp. It kind of changed towards the end of season one, but season two almost feels like our first season, even though I'm really proud of a lot of the episodes we did in our earlier season. But in general,
except for that one episode where I sound like I'm talking like way far away from the mic. Right. I sound like I'm across the kitchen from you.
Yeah.
That was a little embarrassing for me, but it's still good content.
Yeah, absolutely. And we want to thank all of you. I don't think I even told you. We got a couple of screenshots sent to us saying that we were your most listened to podcast of 2019 from Spotify. That is so... I know this sounds demeaning, but it's adorable just to get that. I mean, this is really a two-person operation, and I'm the one that does all of the sound design and editing and remixing and things like that. And I do it because I'm just happy to do it, and I'm always happy to talk to Clinton and see him and talk about my favorite things. But it is absolutely great that it resonates with other people, and I definitely want to express my gratitude towards that.
Mm-hmm. I hear, hear. I double that. Absolutely great thing to do in the new year, too, is to express that gratitude and let people know that you care about them.
Absolutely. So we'll be catching up with y'all soon, and we hope you enjoyed this episode.
Bye.